Welcome to Wrestling with Theology. My name is Doug Minton. I am your host. I am the pastor at Redeemer Evangelical Lutheran Church in Robbinsdale, Minnesota, as well as a lifelong wrestling fan. Wrestling with Theology wrestles with the history of pro wrestling as well as the theology of the Lutheran Church.
What a rush!
That's right. This week we talk about the Road Warriors. The Road Warriors were one of the baddest teams in all of wrestling. You definitely didn't want to cross Hawk or Animal in a dark alley or in a bar fight. These two monsters were the 80s personification of intimidation. They were huge in the AWA in the mid-80s and spawned the creation of WWF's Demolition, but also the Disciples of Apocalypse. Hawk was born Michael Hegstrand in St. Paul, graduating from Patrick Henry High School in North Minneapolis. Unfortunately, Hawk died of a sudden heart attack in his sleep at the age of 46. Animal was born Joe Laurinaitis in Philadelphia, but he was raised in the Twin Cities, graduating from Irondale High School in New Brighton. Both men were trained alongside Barry Darso and Rick Rude by Eddie Sharkey. He believed all four men had the potential to make it big in wrestling. Eddie knew what he was talking about. For the most part, these two wrestled as a tag team. There didn't ever seem to be much of a push for a singles career for these guys after Ole Anderson put them together as a tag team in 83. The Road Warriors gimmick began with Animal. He began wrestling in Minneapolis as the Road Warrior. The tag team began their career in Georgia Championship Wrestling with Precious Paul Ellering as a replacement for his team of Matt Bourne and Arn Anderson after Bourne was fired. After a short time under Ellering, they decided that they didn't need a manager, but that was very short-lived. They went back to Ellering very quickly. From Georgia, they spread through the NWA's southern territories before heading back home to the AWA in 84. They did a long stretch in Japan from 85 until 90, while also working with Jim Crockett Promotions and World Championship Wrestling. In June of 90, they signed a contract with the WWF and immediately began a feud with their Demolition doppelgangers. While on tour in London, Hawk went AWOL and left the WWF. Animal began a new incarnation of the Legion of Doom with a repackaged Crush, but that fizzled out very quickly. Animal finally left the WWF with a back injury in 92. In 92, Hawk went on to Japan and teamed with Kensuke Sasaki as the Power Warrior in the tag team, the Hellraisers. They broke up in 95. When Animal was cleared to return to the ring, the Road Warriors signed a contract with WCW and began a feud with the Steiner Brothers. They left the WCW after 6 months because they felt that Bischoff was screwing them. They returned to the WWF in February 97. At WrestleMania 14, the Road Warriors returned again, now known as LOD 2000, with their new manager, Sonny. They feuded with the Disciples of Apocalypse. Sonny soon dropped the team, but they were joined by Darren Puke Drozdoff. Ellering made a return to the WWF as the manager for the Disciples. There's a great deal of tension among the Road Warriors at this time because of Hawk's alcohol and drug issues. They left the WWF again in late 99, only to reappear on May 12th, 03 to challenge World Tag Team Champions Rob Van Dam and Kane. They were unsuccessful in regaining the titles or a full-time contract, and Hawk died 5 months later. Animal returned to the WWF in 05 to team with John Heidenreich to feud with Eminem, Michael Mercury, and Johnny Nitro. On January 17, 06, Heidenreich was released from his WWF contract. Animal went back to the Road Warrior for a few months before being released himself. On September 1, 07, Animal and Kensuke Sasaki joined forces in All Japan as the Hell Warriors. Their run ended on February 13, 2014, when Sasaki announced his retirement from wrestling. Overall, the Road Warriors were an awesome team. I never understood Sonny as their manager or Darren Drozdoff as a Road Warrior, but not many people ask my opinion before doing things. The Road Warriors were extremely successful wherever they wrestled. They held many titles around the world. Hawk and Animal held the NWA International Tag Team titles in All Japan, the AWA World Tag Team titles, the World Japan Tag Team titles, the NWA National Tag Team titles 4 times, the IWS World Tag Team titles, the iGeneration Tag Team titles 3 times, the IPW Tag Team titles, the NWA World Six-Man Tag Team titles 3 times, and the Mid-Atlantic version of the NWA World Tag Team titles. They were the winners of the Crockett Cup in 86. Four times they were PWI's Tag Team of the Year. They were involved in PWI's Feud of the Year in 87 as the War Games feud between the Road Warriors, Dusty Rhodes, and Nikita Koloff versus the Four Horsemen. Overall, they are ranked number one all time by PWI. Well, they also held the WWF World Tag Team titles twice. They are the 2011 class for the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame as well as the WWE Hall of Fame, and the 2012 class of the NWA Hall of Fame. The Hellraisers, Hawk and Kensuke Sasaki, held the IWGP Tag Team titles twice, and they are ranked number 58 all-time by PWI. Animal and Heidenreich held the WWE Tag Team titles once. The Hell Warriors held the UWA World Tag Team titles once. In all their incarnations, the Road Warriors were a serious team. The one biggest complaint by many wrestlers and fans about them is that they wouldn't sell their opponent's offense. But that was part of the gimmick, I guess. Two big, tough badasses who didn't take anything from anyone. There aren't too many of those guys left in wrestling today. I'll be back in a moment as we dig deeper into Exodus chapter 4. As we continue to dig deeper into the book of Exodus, we now turn ourselves to chapter 4. Moses is still on Mount Sinai talking to God at the burning bush and beginning his list of reasons why he can't be the one that God is calling. I'm sure there are many pastors who would agree with Moses that they wondered if they were the ones that God was calling them to be in a certain place, or if they were being called into the ministry at all. That's human nature. We want to know for certain, but sometimes God just tells us, and it doesn't look like the right thing. So Exodus chapter 4, verse 1. Then Moses answered, "But behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, 'The Lord did not appear to you.' The Lord said to him, 'What is that in your hand?' He said, 'A staff.' And he said, 'Throw it on the ground.' So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses ran from it. But the Lord said to Moses, 'Put out your hand and catch it by the tail.' So he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Again, the Lord said to him, 'Put your hand inside your cloak.' And he put his hand inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then God said, 'Put your hand back inside your cloak.' So he put his hand back inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. 'If they will not believe you,' God said, 'or listen to the first sign, they may believe the latter sign. If they will not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, you shall take some of the water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground.'" God gives Moses three signs to show the Israelites that he sent him to deliver them. This is a very important point. Three signs. Three persons in the Trinity. And when God in the Pentateuch talks about himself, and even when Jesus talks about God to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, it's in three parts. The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. So the three is very important. But the three are also very easily reproducible. The magicians in Pharaoh's court would do these three signs in response to Moses to show Pharaoh that this guy's just a parlor magician like the rest of us. Nobody sent him to bring the Israelites out. So these three signs, the staff turning into a snake, the leprous hand, and the water into blood, become very important when we talk about the bringing the people out from Israel. Now, okay, he's got the signs, but Moses still doesn't think he's the right one. So we pick up in verse 10. But Moses said to the Lord, "Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue." Then the Lord said to him, "Who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you will speak." But he said, "Oh, my Lord, please send someone else." Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses and said, "Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. Behold, he is coming out to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth and will teach you both what to do. He shall speak for you to the people, and he shall be your mouth, and you shall be as God to him. And take in your hand this staff with which you shall do the signs." Moses says, "Lord, I'm not eloquent. And talking to you, I haven't become more eloquent. So isn't there somebody else?" God says, "How about your brother, your older brother Aaron? Why don't I send him? But I will give you the words to tell him. He will be your mouth, and you will be like God to him, just as you are my mouth, and I am your God." So God sets up this hierarchy. Even early on in Exodus, it's God, then Moses, then Aaron. And of course, Aaron would become the high priest at Mount Sinai. So we have God revealing himself in the burning bush in chapter 3, commissioning Moses and Aaron to go in to see Pharaoh to bring his people back. And now we have to go into Egypt. Verse 18. Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Please let me go back to my brothers in Egypt to see whether they are still alive." And Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." And the Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead." So Moses took his wife and his sons and had them ride on a donkey and went back to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the staff of God in his hand. So Moses goes back home off of Mount Sinai, talks to his father-in-law, says, "Let me go back into Egypt to see if my brothers are still alive." He takes his wife and his children and all this to go into Egypt. And he can do this with great confidence because God tells him, "All the men who are seeking your life are dead." Everyone who remembered the murdered Egyptian is now dead. The Pharaoh that was there is now dead. This will be a clean slate for Moses going in to see Pharaoh. But then we have God's words again in verse 21. And the Lord said to Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you do before Pharaoh all the miracles that I have put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son. And I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. If you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your firstborn son.'" God prophesies and promises two things in this one statement. First, that God will harden Pharaoh's heart so that all of the miracles and signs that God will bring through Moses will be done, that not one of them will be left out. Not one of the plagues will be done. And secondly, he promises the last plague, the death of the firstborn, and not just anybody's firstborn. He promises Pharaoh's firstborn son will die as well. Now, I'm sure that did not go over well the first time Moses said that to Pharaoh. Now we get to verse 24. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it and said, "Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me." So he let him alone. It was then that she said, "a bridegroom of blood," because of the circumcision. Interesting point here in the return of Moses to Egypt, where God appears to him and wants to put Moses to death. The same God that had just sent him into Egypt is now wanting to kill him. Why? His son is not circumcised. So Zipporah, Moses' wife, takes a flint, cuts off her son's foreskin, and touches Moses' feet with it, and calls him a bridegroom of blood. She is submitting herself to this whole law that God has given through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob all the way down into Moses, that the circumcision is important. So that for Moses to be able to do his job, he has to be able to even follow the law that is there. So verse 27. On the other side, while we're in Egypt, the Lord said to Aaron, "Go into the wilderness to meet Moses." So he went and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord with which he had sent him to speak, and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and did the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed, and when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel, and that he had seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshipped. The people were happy that their prayers had finally been answered. Their prayers for deliverance from the oppression of the Egyptians were finally being answered. They were there in the person of Moses, and all they had to do was get Pharaoh to let them go. But we know that doesn't happen, and this faithful and cheerfulness of the elders of the people doesn't last very long. But we will get to that next time when we dig deeper into Exodus chapters 5 and 6. Thank you for your time and listening to this podcast. If you'd like to hear more, go back to our archives to hear the previous episodes of Wrestling with Theology. Also hear Sunday morning sermons from Redeemer. If you are in the Twin Cities area on Sunday morning, you are welcome to join us at Redeemer Evangelical Lutheran Church at 4201 Regent Avenue North in Robbinsdale, just off of the corner of 42nd Avenue and Highway 100. Just look for Jesus blessing the travelers along the road. Our services are at 9 a.m. We have Bible study at 10:30 following the service, with coffee hour in between. We encourage you, anytime you are in the area, to join us for worship and to wrestle with theology with us.